Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. Today we're going to talk about Egypt, its Gaza policy, and the war's impact on Egypt's economy and politics.
The forced displacement of Palestinians from Gaza into Egypt would set a concerning precedent, potentially leading to displacement of Palestinians from the West back into Jordan. Consequently, the Palestinian state, which has been discussed by the international community, may become unattainable.
Egyptians have felt the Gaza war perhaps more than anyone except Palestinians and Israelis. There's the economic impact on tourism, gas exports and revenues from the Suez Canal, as strikes from the Houthi militant group in Yemen disrupt Red Sea shipping. Cairo's been involved in mediation, hosting several rounds of indirect talks between Israel and Hamas. There's also the fear, which in some ways has guided Egypt's Gaza policy, of Palestinians' forced displacement from the Strip into Egypt's Sinai region. We just heard Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi warning against that in mid-October. The fear hasn't gone away. Sisi just last week repeated those warnings, particularly as Israeli leaders threatened a ground operation in the southernmost Gazan city of Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians now shelter. This is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a couple of days ago.
We'll enter Rafah because we have no other choice. We'll destroy the Hamas battalions there. We will complete all the objectives of the war, including the repatriation of all the abductees.
So should Egyptian officials still worry about an exodus of Palestinians into the Sinai? Or could the latest round of Cairo talks, which took place just this past week, avert a Rafah offensive? For how long can investment by the Gulf, bailouts from the International Monetary Fund and the European Union, stave off Egypt's economic collapse? And what future does Cairo see for Gaza, for Hamas, and for talks between Israelis and Palestinians? To talk about all this, I'm very happy to welcome back on Riccardo Fabiani, who is Crisis Group's North Africa Director, Darin Khalifa, who is Crisis Group's Senior Dialogue Advisor, and Michael Hanna, who's our US Director. Michael, Darin, Riccardo, welcome back on.
Good to be back with you.
Great to be on.
Great to be back, Richard. Thank you.
So let's start then with the latest round of talks in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. So some reports of progress towards another ceasefire deal?
I mean, I would start by saying that there is movement. I wouldn't use the word optimism, but some guarded hopes that some of the gaps that have bedeviled previous phases might be closed. Now, the caveat here is that I think U.S. officials and others have thought at various previous junctures, particularly in the run-up to Ramadan, that a ceasefire was imminent, and those hopes have been dashed previously. So some guarded hopes around these discussions, and what has changed in recent weeks is that there is a discussion now about a multi-phase process, and this initial phase that people have pinned their hopes on is roughly 6 weeks. A discussion about an immediate temporary ceasefire, accompanied by the beginning of an Israeli pullback from some population centers, and then the release of some hostages. And the number heavily negotiated, but women, elderly, and children in this first phase, and the release of some Palestinian prisoners. Again, something that is being negotiated in terms of a final number. It's phased within this 6 week period, including some continued redeployment, some reports that this would include Israeli pullback from what they have called the Netzarim Corridor, which effectively bisects the Gaza Strip in two, and has been one of the sticking points in many ways, because one of the key demands from Hamas has been the return of population to the central and northern parts of the Gaza Strip. And really, there is a lot of focus on the so-called second phase, an attempt to bridge the kind of core gap here.
Michael, the core gap being, in essence, that Hamas doesn't want to commit to a temporary ceasefire without assurances that it's going to turn into something permanent. Israel, in the past, hasn't want to guarantee something permanent, wanting to keep its options open for further military operations.
That's right. That question of permanence has been and continues to be the biggest issue in the ceasefire discussions. And so The new bit of language that has been introduced to try to bridge this gap is this phrase about a sustainable period of calm. And previously, the United States, through the Qatari and Egyptian mediators, has effectively sent indirect assurances to Hamas and the Palestinians that this would, in turn, become a permanent ceasefire. And those indirect assurances haven't been enough. And Israel, of course, wants to keep its options open. And whether that is a ploy to exert pressure, dangling the idea of a Rafah offensive as a way to force the hand in negotiations, or whether this represents ultimate intent on the part of Israel, I think is an unknown and continues to be so. Just very recently, Prime Minister Netanyahu has told Secretary of State Antony Blinken that he cannot accept a permanent ceasefire, a permanent end to conflict. And so, again, whether this is posturing within the negotiations, but there is some hope that this discussion of a sustained period of calm can bridge this fundamental divide among the parties.
And it's not just Netanyahu, of course, who we heard up top talking about Rafah. I mean, different Israeli politicians put different weight on getting out the hostages, for example, but most argue that Israel is going to go into Rafah, and we'll come in a moment to what that might mean for Egypt. But could you, Michael, say something about how Cairo is involved in the talks? Which Egyptian official leads from their side? How do they coordinate with the Qataris, who are also involved, the Americans? How do they engage the Israelis and Hamas?
Yeah, I mean, this has traditionally been the province of Egypt's intelligence services, the GIS, the General Intelligence Services. Abbas Gemen is the head of Egypt's intelligence at the moment. He's had a core role. Egypt has effectively reconstructed its ties with Hamas in recent years. In the immediate aftermath of the military's ouster of Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's regional policy was a reflection of its domestic policy.
That was 2013.
2013, exactly. And in the immediate years after, the regional policy sort of channeled what they were doing domestically. And that meant a very hard line on regional Islamism, including Hamas, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. It wasn't until later years that Egypt took a sort of pragmatic turn. And this led them to, not out of love for Hamas, but out of their own security interests, to reconstruct their ties and their channels of communication with Hamas leaders to protect, particularly against cross-border activity flowing into the Sinai Peninsula, where there was a low-level insurgency. And I think Egypt also realized that the role of mediator in these recurrent conflicts in Gaza gave them some regional salience. And so we've seen them reprise that role at present. The offer that is on the table at the moment has been described as an Egyptian initiative. I think that's probably generous. Egypt is one of the key channels to Hamas in terms of communication. Geography is important here. The other important player as a mediator is Qatar. Interesting that Egypt and Qatar have not been on great terms, although they are mending their relationship and it's on much firmer footing than it was. They have come to, I think, an effective understanding. And of course, there's a lot of close coordination with the United States. And that continues.
So let's back up a bit and look at how Egypt has responded to the aftermath of 7th of October, Hamas's attacks, the war in Gaza, and the war's repercussions for Egypt. And I want to talk in a moment about the impact on the Egyptian economy, its foreign relations. But perhaps let's start with this fear that has really guided a lot of what Egypt has said about the war, that it could involve or could lead to the expulsion or forced displacement of people in Gaza into Egypt, into the Sinai. That's a fear that seems to have ebbed and flowed as the war has evolved, but with a Rafah operation, at least potentially on the cards. Could you say something about how Cairo views that risk?
Yeah, I would say that from the start of the war, probably Egypt's messaging on this specific point has been extremely consistent. to the point almost of sounding like a broken record. The message has been repeated on and on that any scenario of forcible displacement of the Palestinians into Egypt's Sinai Peninsula was unacceptable. It would have crossed the red line for Egypt. But the real aim of this messaging has really been to mobilize Egypt's Western partners and to create this sort of almost like a coalition or a collective effort, if you like, to preempt the scenario of forced displacement and to convey the message, obviously, to the Israelis eventually, that this was obviously something that they should avoid. But I would say that at the same time, as you mentioned, also the sense of urgency behind this fear of mass displacement in a way has ebbed and flowed, driven by the evolving circumstances on the ground. Because at the beginning, Egyptian messaging was very much justified by the fact that Israeli officials were constantly referring to this possibility. Later on, as the conflict evolved, I would say the circumstances also changed, and the reason for Egypt's concern with this possibility, or Egypt's fears of this scenario, also changed. Probably several weeks into the conflict, particularly with the deterioration of the humanitarian conditions for the Palestinian population in Gaza, that really became the main reason, the main fear for the Egyptians, that the situation would become so bad that effectively for the Palestinians, crossing the border and taking refuge in Egypt would become the only possible way out. So the messaging remained the same, but the reasons, I would say, behind this messaging changed. And obviously, there were moments in which the circumstances seemed to become more compelling.
Richard, if I may add to what Ricardo is saying, I think if we want to summarize Egypt's position on this, it could be put into three categories: political, economic, and security concerns. The political concern is basically the deep fear of hollowing out the Palestinian cause by moving large segments of the Palestinian society that is currently residing in Gaza onto Egypt. And the economic concern is also, there is a fear that they're going to have to shoulder the burden of hundreds and thousands of Palestinians moving into Egypt at a moment of economic crisis and uncertainty in regards to Egypt's economic future. There's also a security concern that I think Ricardo captured very well, is the fear that they are not going to be able to control and vet people coming into Egypt if and when there is a massive population flow into Sinai. They don't think they have the ability to control a massive militant infiltration among the IDP communities or among the refugee community coming in. The Sisi government struggled for many years at the beginning of its presidency with a low-level insurgency in Sinai that was incredibly damaging for the economy, but it was also incredibly damaging for tourism, for its political standing, for its domestic standing. And that came at a huge cost, and they're very fearful in Cairo of a repetition of that scenario once more. I would just also add that these sentiments are shared by the general public. So your average Egyptian holds both feelings, a deep empathy to the Palestinian cause, but also not wanting to bear the brunt or to share the responsibility of having to host thousands of Palestinian refugees. So there's a lot of public backing to this Egyptian position in public messaging on it.
So maybe just let me ask something sort of for the historical record. I mean, it's something we certainly hear from Arab officials. I think on something like the 15th of October, US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said explicitly that the US didn't support the forced transfer of Gaza's population. So that really came unambiguously from Washington about a week into the war. But before then, we've heard the message from Western politicians wasn't so clear. How do you see the claims that in the early days after the 7th of October, some Western politicians were sort of exploring the idea of Egypt taking in Palestinians? And, you know, if those are credible, how much did that shape the way Cairo sort of perceived that risk?
So we've heard from Egyptian officials that there's been early on in the war visits by European officials, basically testing waters and testing the idea of what it would take for Egypt to accept a large number of Palestinian refugees in return for loans to the Egyptian government, offering some kind of bailout. It was never explicitly put as an offer on the table, but the sense in Cairo was that they were testing waters on that. So I think that really fueled Egyptian fears of that scenario. But also, even when the Europeans and the Americans started becoming more explicit on the refusal of that scenario, I don't think it's taken very credibly in Cairo. I think there is a sense that there's inconsistency when it comes to how the West is dealing with this war. So I would say there is still a lack of trust in what the West is actually doing and saying.
And of course, if there is an offensive into Rafah, it's almost immaterial what the United States and others have assured Egypt, because there's over 1 million Palestinians who have effectively been displaced within Gaza, in and around Rafah. And if there is a full-scale Israeli operation, there aren't places for them to go. The only safe route is into Sinai, into Egypt. And so, in a sense, the practical reality of the situation is such that assurances from whoever can only go so far.
I mean, I should probably say that Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Netanyahu, have said that, you know, it's not their intention to push people into Sinai. I mean, how credible Cairo views those statements, you know, what would happen if there was, as you say, Michael, a full-scale operation in Rafah, you know, that is a different thing. But Netanyahu has explicitly denied that's the intention. How should we understand Egypt's construction in the Sinai of this sort of big enclosed area near Gaza that looks a lot like it might be used to house displaced people?
I guess the best way to think about this construction is contingency planning. Of course, you know, Egypt refuses the possibility of the scenario of mass displacement. At the same time, what could happen in Rafah is a massive source of concern for the Egyptians. The military operations by the Israeli forces in Rafah could force many displaced people to try and look for shelter across the border. And that would put Egypt in an extremely difficult position, right? Because on the one hand, they don't want to become host to a massive refugee population. On the other hand, if all of a sudden there is a flow of people towards the border, how would they deal with this? They wouldn't want to be seen necessarily, let's say, taking very difficult measures to try and push back this refugee population, and obviously that would look terrible domestically, internationally, regionally. So the construction of that sort of buffer area, or let's say a potential camp along the border with Gaza, should be probably considered as a sort of contingency option, planning option, where you're ready to at least host a certain number of refugees, of course not all of them, because in Rafah we're talking about more than 1 million displaced people. That area could probably host around 100,000, if something more. But at least it would be a way of absorbing a part of this movement of people. It would be a way also of isolating them from the rest of the Sinai Peninsula. But again, this is just contingency planning for a nightmare scenario, and it's understandable that the authorities at all levels have never really fully acknowledged that this is happening, right? Because implicitly this could be seen or interpreted as a green light for the Israelis.
So can we talk a bit then about the impact of the war on Egyptians' living conditions and the Egyptian economy, arguably the economy that's been hardest hit, except, you know, those of the Palestinians, of course, and of Israel?
So the best way to understand what is happening right now with the Egyptian economy is that there was a pre-existing economic crisis that was triggered by the impact of COVID-19. That obviously was devastating to begin with the impact on business activity, tourism, and so on. Then there was the increase in interest rates globally, which meant that the costs of Egyptian debt went through the roof. Then on top of that, the Gaza war comes in with negative consequences for tourism, particularly in the Sinai Peninsula, the South Sinai being one of the major, let's say, sources of foreign revenues for Egypt. Impact for the Suez Canal, again, another major source of foreign revenues. and then a decline in natural gas exports from Israel via Egypt to Europe, which also had an impact for power generation in the country, given that Egypt uses some of this Israeli gas to produce electricity, among other things. So the overall net impact was cumulative, right, in a way. So this last bit, this last conflict really was the straw that broke the camel's back. It really pushed Egypt from a situation of crisis to a situation of emergency. This crisis that was started to threaten the stability of the Egyptian economy, starting to threaten the exchange rate. We saw a massive drop on the black market with the Egyptian pound at some point dropping from around 30, which was the official rate, to 70 to the dollar. This is in a context where the Egyptian pound has already been weakened. The inflation is around 30 to 40%. So the whole picture looked, I would say, extremely worrying. And that, I would say, perception, that idea that Egypt was on the brink of a potential economic disaster was very clearly understood and received abroad, right? Particularly in Europe, in the Gulf, and in the US, and obviously with the major international financial institutions.
And we'll talk in a moment about how, as you say, the Gulf, Europe, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund have responded. But the macroeconomic picture that you paint, I mean, what's been the impact of that for Egyptians in terms of living costs, living standards, and who do they blame?
So I think, I mean, those last few months have been the most significant challenge to the Sisi presidency since 2014, I would say. I mean, I would argue even a challenge bigger than the one they had to handle with their Islamist opposition or with the jihadi insurgency. And it's obviously largely a self-inflicted wound. And I'm sure we'll talk more about how the military hasn't been handling the economy. But the crisis has been so severe and so deeply felt among Egyptians that even despite the war in Gaza right next door, that these economic struggles is the topic dominating every conversation among Egyptians. I see it with my family, I see it with my friends, I see it with people on the street. Up until last month, the exchange rate of the pound to the dollar changed significantly every day. Widespread shortages of basic goods, actual inflation rate had reached almost 100%. You walk into a supermarket and the supermarkets just stopped pricing goods because they didn't know how to. And many businesses just shut down entirely. I mean, people were struggling, but I think more visibly, people were angry. And they were expressing their anger at the military and at the presidency in very vocal ways, including on social media, but also like in public gatherings, on the streets and coffee shops. And this is really unusual, given the level of political repression and fear in general. And as Ricardo says, fast forward a few months, comes an Emirati investment deal, and the exchange rate stabilizes, prices go slightly down. So the general perception is that the worst is behind us. And I, and economic experts in general who follow Egypt closely, are concerned because that public perception doesn't necessarily match the reality. And I think, again, fundamentally, the key issue here is that we should not underestimate the military's ability to massively misuse this bailout the same way they have in the past.
So that Emirati investment, Doreen just mentioned, an Emirati company has or will put, I think, $35 billion into developing part of Egypt's Mediterranean coast. Was that motivated mostly by keeping Egypt afloat, heading off potential discontent at Sisi, or is there something else behind it?
I think what's interesting about the Emirati investment, and they see it as an investment, and what I mean by that is that, you know, following the military ouster of Morsi, the Gulf came in with a massive bailout package, which effectively had no strings attached, upwards of $20 billion. I think over the subsequent years, there has been a lot of rethinking of that approach, disillusionment with how Egypt handled that influx of funds. And, you know, prior to the Gaza war, we saw something of a hard line coming out of the Gulf about no more bailouts. The Gulf was effectively not going to be an ATM to bail out Egypt every time it was in trouble.
And I mean, that also came at a time when relations between Sisi, you know, who, as you say, had got a lot of support from the Gulf since overthrowing Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi But relations between him and the Emiratis were, for a while, quite difficult, right? Quite fraught.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Egypt-Emirati relations previously were at a low point. I think relations with the Saudis have been fraught. And this new approach, it seemed to align with where the international financial institutions were, including the IMF, that the sort of too-big-to-fail model was a thing of the past, and that funds would be conditional on what the Egyptians were ready to do in terms of economic reform. And everything changes, as Ricardo mentioned, after Gaza, after the spillover effects really begin to take this massive toll. And I think Egypt's Western partners, including the United States, start to think about worst case scenarios. And you see a reassessment of how they're thinking about the economic situation. And I think for the Gulf and particularly Emirates, I think it's a combination of both their sense that Egypt was teetering, but also that this wasn't and doesn't look like a kind of traditional bailout. This is a real investment and one that I know Emirati officials think will pay off.
So in addition to the Emirati investment, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, so what it had loaned, I think $3 billion to Egypt in late 2022, then stopped disbursing that money when it became clear Egypt wouldn't follow through on the reforms that it had promised. But the IMF has now, just weeks ago in March, agreed to a bailout of even more, $5 billion. Plus, the EU has now agreed to a package of what, loans, investment, grants of about $7.5 billion. Are there new conditions on those packages?
The conditions are there, for sure. I would say there's been a very clear list of measures that the IMF has published when they announced the deal with Egypt. What we know, of course, is that the military and the army in Egypt has always been heavily involved in economic activities. But under Sisi, there's really been a qualitative and quantitative leap in terms of how much these military companies are nowadays involved in many sectors of the economy and how many contracts they currently execute on behalf of the government, which has had a negative effect in terms of private sector activity, business activity. So this was a major objective for the IMF back in 2022-2023 when the previous deal with Egypt was announced. And it was a sticking point because Egypt never really did much in that respect, which also contributed to the suspension of that deal with the IMF throughout in the course of 2023. And then the Gaza war arrived and there was a decision to renegotiate the deal and to reopen effectively the terms of this loan. So we have seen for the first time Egypt implement a serious devaluation of the exchange rate, which was something that the Egyptians had refused to do. There are other measures regarding fiscal consolidation, privatization, and the sale of state-owned assets. So from the IMF perspective, there are still things that obviously they want, but the breadth and the ambition of this reform program seems to have shrunk. When it comes to the EU, the story is different because the EU deal, I would say, was driven by a major concern with the migration situation. The Europeans really looked at what was happening in Gaza, Egypt being host to millions of refugees from various countries such as Sudan, Syria, and so on. And the deal that they offered to Egypt was really focused on the need to avoid the instability in Egypt. We need to support Egypt in this very difficult time. So here's all this money that we are giving to you for cooperation in a series of sectors, whether it's digital transition or renewable energy. But the reality is that when it comes to the conditionality of this money offered by the EU, the list seems to be very thin.
And when you think of some of the structural problems of the Egyptian economy that Ricardo, you talked about, particularly the military's control over much of the Egyptian economy,
making it very unattractive for foreign investment. Is that the sort of thing that President Sisi, is that the sort of thing that he's likely to be able to act on?
So I think it's important, as Ricardo mentioned, to note that this is a different kind of economic political setup to the Mubarak years. It's qualitatively different. The role of the military, its footprint in the economy is fundamentally different. And that reflects, I think, two important things which make its reform very, very challenging. First, I think there is a kind of ideological approach to this military-led economy. And what I mean by that is that there is something of a kind of throwback to the statism that sort of dominated economic development in previous decades in Egypt, particularly during the Nasser era. This military-led, grand project-driven approach to development. And then second, of course, is that the base of support for Sisi is within the military, and this effectively functions as a patronage system. It's very difficult to imagine Sisi tampering with that model because it forms the core of his support. And I think when they collectively think about sustainability and threats to their stability, I think they're thinking first and foremost about their institutional stability and stability within the armed forces.
And beyond the economic challenges, Egyptians have also been protesting about what's happening in Gaza, protests in solidarity with the Palestinians. How has Sisi responded to those protests, and has any of that anger been directed at his government?
So, you know, Richard, I grew up in Cairo under former President Hosni Mubarak and went to government-run schools and universities. And needless to say that there wasn't a whole lot of tolerance for political expression. But one of the few areas that there was some opening for us to, as students at the time, was to demonstrate pro-Palestine and anti-Israel. Of course, that was a deliberate choice by Mubarak at the time, and also by a lot of regional governments. They looked at it as political venting, right? It's a non-threatening space for political venting in that regard. I mean, ironically, Islamists at the time were allowed more room to assemble within university mosques and so on. But for liberal students and socialist labor movements, this was the one topic in which people were allowed to demonstrate. And of course, that over time created some space for civil society and for activists to meet and to network. And these networks later on played a fundamental role to the build-up to the 2011 revolution in Egypt that ultimately ousted President Mubarak. Now, that is a lesson that this government has really learned. They know from historical precedent in a country of over 100 million people and in a city like Cairo that has over 28 million people with high levels of education and also high levels of frustration, things can quickly spiral out of control. What can start as calls for social justice and reform can quickly become calls for regime change. And they can't allow that. And that's where the fear of pro-Palestine demonstrations come in. So what we've seen in the last few months is that the government has allowed for a limited amount of pro-Palestine demonstrations and have quickly cracked down on them and arrested a few members of them. And I think that comes from genuine fear that things can get out of control really quickly and that the authorities don't have the ability or capacity to do crowd control in a way that won't trigger violence or won't escalate relatively quickly. And that given the deep level of frustration from the economic situation, from the economic crisis, that this could create momentum and attract more segments of society that are deeply frustrated by how the economy has been managed.
And what are prospects for Egypt, for Sisi opening up some political space in response? What, he just won presidential elections in December. It looked as though there might be one serious opposition candidate. In the end, he couldn't contest. So Sisi won with, what, 89% of the vote, I think, ran pretty much unopposed. I mean, what's the chance his government now, facing this sort of economic frustration, eases off a bit, whether that's, what, releasing political prisoners, allowing the press a bit more space, allowing some party activity, for example?
I think, I mean, we need to differentiate between like three categories of politically unresolved issues in Egypt. One, the high level court cases against like well-known civil society activists and political figures. The second is like thousands of people who were detained post-2014, most of which are or were collateral really in the waves of mass arrests against the Muslim Brotherhood. And The third category is the Muslim Brotherhood affiliates, vocal sympathizers and family members. There's been some movement on the first category, highly visible cases of activists with strong advocates in Western capitals, in particular European capitals. We're yet to see any movement on the second category, that is the thousands of arbitrarily detained people in Egyptian prisons. And in my view, we're highly unlikely to see any movement on the third, that is the Muslim Brotherhood and their families and vocal sympathizers. So, for example, we've seen the government end a 10-year-old court case against key Egyptian NGOs for receiving foreign funding, and it lifted travel bans and assets freeze against their members. I think that is partly because the government understands that they need to give something to their Western donors, something that would look like a political opening, but don't amount to anything that is politically threatening. But on the Muslim Brotherhood and in Islamists in general, I think the reality is that there isn't a whole lot of demand or pressure on the government to show any opening on that file.
I agree with Darin. The changes that the Egyptians have been willing to contemplate over the past few years have been mostly cosmetic and gestures towards either the Biden administration or the Europeans. There was never any intention to seriously change the tenets, let's say, of the system that is very much based on the idea of zero tolerance towards any degree of dissension. The Europeans have put the Egyptian strategy for human rights as a reference in their loan to Egypt to try and use documents and strategies that the Egyptians themselves have elaborated as a way of putting pressure on the Egyptians themselves. I doubt that this strategy will work. These documents are mostly performative documents by the Egyptians. And I would also say that there is a degree of performativity also from the European side, because concerns regarding governance in Egypt, I wouldn't say they are top of the priority list in Brussels or anywhere else in Europe at the moment.
So let's end then by coming back to Gaza and the talks that have been happening in Cairo this past week and previously. It's been quite hard. I mean, I met with senior Egyptian officials myself. I mean, it's quite hard to pass out how Cairo sees Gaza's future and a way forward. Egyptian officials, like their sort of other Arab counterparts, Egyptian officials are reluctant to take a position without a ceasefire, without the Palestinians, partly maybe because the trajectory of the war seems to be headed towards something that is a long way from anything that Cairo, other Arab capitals would view as acceptable. But if you think of what interim governance in Gaza, if there is a ceasefire, Hamas's future, its future role, the longer term sort of idea that the US is working on of the Saudis normalizing relations with Israel in exchange for concrete progress towards Palestinian statehood. I mean, is it possible to get much of a sense of how Cairo views those things or how Cairo views a way out?
I think first and foremost, Cairo, like many other of the regional parties, is desperate for an end to the war. They see this as politically and economically damaging, and you know, looming out there is the risk demonstrated by the sort of near miss between Iran and Israel of an all-out regional war, which would be sort of cataclysmic for Egypt and the region. And what we've seen in the ceasefire discussions is details around the first 6 weeks, the first phase, and as you progress outward, fewer and fewer details about what did the discussions about a sustainable period of calm look like. And that sort of third phase of political horizon remains very, very sketchy. There haven't been detailed discussions about what people have referred to as the day after in terms of political and security control of Gaza. We've seen this recurring idea that is apparently making the rounds again, of an international peacekeeping force, effectively, of an outside force to bridge the security gap. And there has been mention of Egypt participating. I remain skeptical, but the lack of good options, I think, mean that it is resuscitated from time to time, and it is something that diplomats are again discussing. From the Egyptian perspective, in terms of what this political dispensation looks like, I think they have come around to the view that Hamas is part of Palestinian society, is unlikely to be eradicated through military means, And that there will have to be some reckoning within Palestinian society and within the Palestinian national movement to account for this kind of broad spectrum of views. Beyond that, I don't know that we have much granularity.
And maybe just to end, taking advantage of you being on, Michael, clearly the US is still hoping that Saudi normalization of Saudi-Israel relations can be part of finding an end to the war and a longer-term incentive for Israel to return to the idea of two states, even if that's not something that appears likely with this Israeli government. Now, we're recording this on Wednesday. Just today, there's this idea now circulating that maybe Riyadh would like a more modest deal with the US, one that doesn't link to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so basically a sort of bilateral defense pact between the US and the Saudis. The US would help build a Saudi civil nuclear energy industry, amongst other things. Presumably the Saudis would distance themselves from Russia and China. I mean, I can see the attraction for Riyadh, but interested if you think that sort of deal, you know, that's not linked again to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is plausible. But beyond that, clearly this idea of Saudi normalization with Israel still a centerpiece of American diplomacy beyond the efforts to get a ceasefire.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is clear that these are real and very thorough and longstanding discussions that predated October 7th. I know that there are some within the administration who believe that if it wasn't for October 7th, that we would have already seen a normalization package and deal. I'm not super confident of that, but there are some who hold that view, and I think it's a reflection of how far those discussions have gone. I think the U.S.-Saudi piece of it, I think, has been largely worked out. I mean, we know the broad outlines of what that would look like. And the chief hurdle, one of a few, but the chief hurdle is Israeli politics and whether Israel could give enough of a promise on the political horizon, you know, the irreversible steps for Palestinian statehood, whether they could give enough on that front to sustain this normalization push. And of course, with this Israeli government, it's very, very hard to imagine that happening. It's also very hard to imagine, as you mentioned, a decoupling of this trilateral arrangement in which you just isolate the U.S.-Saudi pieces of it, because it's not politically tenable to move forward with that arrangement that would require, a vote in the Senate without this piece of Saudi Israel normalization. And so we're left with, one, a very compressed time frame before elections here in the United States in November. And so this deal, while sketched out in some great detail, remains hard to imagine because primarily, you know, the first and foremost, the war in Gaza is not over. And, you know, there's a hope to tie the end of war in Gaza and the ceasefire with this normalization push, in which the Saudis can effectively take some public acclaim for helping bring the war to an end. So that's the theory of the case. But again, the challenges remain such that it's hard to imagine this all coming together between now and the fall.
Michael, Ricardo, Darin, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. You can find all of Crisis Group's work on Egypt and on the war in Gaza on our website, crisisgroup.org. We've got a paper coming out soon that covers a lot of the ground that we've covered in this episode, so do look out for that. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, and thanks, as ever, to all our listeners. Please do get in touch, podcast@crisisgroup.org or atwood@crisisgroup.org. If you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, if you like the show, please, as usual, give us a nice review wherever you get your podcasts. And I very much hope that you'll join us again next week.